This is a Sports Fusion podcast production. SF is a comprehensive sports show that is built for the regular everyday fan. I focus on the NFL, NBA, MLB, and throw in some NHL. My NFL fantasy football tips are on point. Predictions, tips, picks, and barbershop banter. I am Jay Rich, and this is Sports Fusion. So, Epe, the Ohtani allegations hits the Fed. When gambling was legalized, sports should expect some players chasing the bread. Baseball isn't the only sport going through March Madness. No upsets here as the top teams advance, leaving small school sadness. Sweet 16 pick, NFL news, baseball starts under a black cloud. All that's next right here on Sports Fusion. Let's go. I'm certainly not giving my interpreter the keys to my account and access to 4.7 milli. Baseball starts and suffers through another conspiracy with that Ohtani excuse sounding pretty silly. University of Oakland proves a four-year approach can create a matchup that could put the school on the map, with other teams doing the same, creating some very weird age gaps. Let's talk Sweet 16 first. Let's go. First, my take on week one of the big dance. I noticed that high seeds are making it look easy in this tournament, unlike before. You always see a 16, 15, or 14 kind of at least win a couple games and get to the Sweet 16, which really isn't the case up to this point. And the big teams are really smoking the smaller school teams early here in the tournament pretty easily. High seeds making it look easy, but less high-end NBA prospects on those teams. Outside of UConn, that is. But this is a subtle paradigm shift of big programs exclusively committing to a one-and-doneer and shifting to longer-stayed elite college players and trying to get 3 and 4 years out of them and more out of their scholarship investment. I like that. It also makes for more of an X and O game and more of a coaching system game than it does, of obviously, in the NBA. In this year's tournament, it's certainly playing out. Like I said, outside of UConn, who will have two first-rounders going, the number two seed in the East is Iowa State. They have zero first-rounders that are projected to go in the NBA draft. Illinois has one, maybe late first-rounder, in Terrence Shannon. In the West, number one Carolina's starting lineup is the average age of 23 years old. The average age of OKC's starting lineup, which is a breakout team in the NBA right now, is 25. The Arizona team has a maybe late first or second rounder in Keshawn Johnson. They're number two in the West. Houston has a number one seed in the South, but obviously has no top-end NBA talent, and three guards that are all mature and have been in college basketball for a while. Marquette's the number two seed in the South, and they have one late second rounder. Now, a really good example would be Purdue with Zach Eddy, who after maybe winning two college basketball players of the year, is going to be a late first rounder and will struggle to stay on the floor in the NBA because of defense. Tennessee has no one. They're the number two seed in the Midwest. And Creighton has Trey Alexander as a late first rounder at best. So even though there's teams blowing other teams out by 30 and 40 here, the NBA talent isn't there as it's been in the past generations. I kind of like this scenario. It makes it more of an X and O game, but we're seeing a real paradigm shift to more of a coaching program and more of a program where kids stick around. Let's go. Obviously, you're checking in now. You've heard my show. A lot of times in the NFL, I go strictly analytics and all. Obviously, in Major League Baseball, I use analytics a lot when I come up with analogy and and players analysis. But essentially, I've only watched a couple teams closely in the college year this year. And of course, they will be facing off against each other here. So the only pick I have for you for the Sweet 16 moving forward is the Houston and Duke game. Now, obviously, the program has been in great shape with Sampson for the last 3 years, especially as they have kept those seniors, low ceiling type guys together in Cryer, Sharp, and Shad. Check that sheet. And they're mostly a perimeter team that shoots around 38% three-point range. In the tournament, Sharp is at 39%, Cryer is at 39%. And so you see that the problem with playing Duke, who has a big in Clay Flipkowski, they're going to have a hard time matching up with them. Actually, their biggest player that has the most minutes or gets enough minutes to even be considered a matchup for Flipkowski is Francis at 6'8". And so essentially, that is a terrible mismatch. So right off the bat, you can see the Houston squad is going to have to play some zone defense, maybe some matchup zone defense. But at the end of it, him and Roberts, the other forward slash center, who's at 6'7 for Houston, is going to have a hard time matching up with Flip, which means they're going to have to play a lot of zone against Duke. That would be good against most teams if they weren't one-dimensional. But Flipkowski is going to carve his space within 4 to 8 feet inside the basket. And then essentially, Roach, McLean, and Proctor are elite all-conference type guards. So on the defensive side, Duke will be able to play one-on-one against Sharp, Cryer, and the others. And with all that, I feel that Houston will be forced defensively out of what their comfort zone usually is, and they'll have to match up with the big in the middle, and then that's going to leave open shooters. Those open shooters, Roach, McCain, and Proctor, both respectively in this order, shoot 44, 42%, and 47% from the three-point line. And so essentially you can see Flipkowski's going to be able to kick the ball out. They're going to be able to move the ball around the perimeter. There's going to be an open shooter that hits it at 40%. That spread is at 3.5%. Houston has no center to play. Houston can't stand the physical play that is coming their way from Duke, and Duke will play straight up man against Houston with very good matchups at the guard, which is actually Houston's strength. I've got Duke covering that 3.5. Let's go. The elephant in the room for Major League Baseball is Shohei Ohtani. As you know, I did a podcast series for the Angels for the last couple of seasons. And I have split emotions on this topic. I'll try to fill you in like you don't know too much without being one of those guys that thinks they're a reporter and reporting the news that the mainstream media reports. I do know this as a layman with his own podcast. Essentially, I think Epe probably had the greatest, that's the translator for Shohei Ohtani, by the way, had the greatest job in all of Japan. Come to America, live in sunny California, make $300,000 to $500,000 a year. And I'm sure the lineup for applications when Ohtani declared in Japan he was going to come to California, I'm sure the applications were in the tens of thousands for someone that could speak English. So I find it highly unlikely, outside of the fact that, you know, gambling is a disease. I don't know anything about it, although giving some sporting tips here and there based on my sports knowledge, I don't actually bet. And so outside of the disease or the dysfunction, why would Epe be placing bets for himself when he has the dream job, made it off the island, and came to sunny California, maybe the greatest place in America to live? And then the next takeaway I have from that is, why does he have access to Shohei Ohtani's money? I mean, if I have employees and they have a gold card to take care of their expenses while they're working. I understand something like that, but just flat out disregard for your own bank account and your own balance, I feel that that's a little bit of a stretch. And as far as the feds are concerned, which are investigating the situation, that seems to be a little bit of a misnomer. Outside of that, the California sales tax is high. I'm no accountant, but at the end of it, I feel that a $30 million salary, which I think it was last year and maybe the year before, I think the year before he even made less outside of paying your agent and obviously paying an interpreter and some other expenses. You could probably guess his baseball net worth for one season, we'll call it last season, was probably around $15 million, $14 million. And we're talking, or the feds have reported, the main media have reported, around $4.7 million in bets. So you tell me, do you feel that if you had $1,000 in your bank account, you would be willing to give $333 to your driver or whoever it may be working for you? I find that also very, very suspicious. And then he found out later by somebody reporting that one third of his gross salary, or check that net salary for last season, was missing because his interpreter, the guy's been beside him for six solid years, ripped him off. Also, not doing it in front of the camera tells me that he has very wise and intelligent representation, as that was just an audio slash reporter type disclaimer, I guess you would call it at this point. To me, I feel that sports have forever changed since gambling in sports has become legal. This is a byproduct of that. I mentioned it in the opening with some of the clever language that I put in the opening in the bridge there. With all that, you know, if it is a disease, we're going to see more and more of this in spite of these guys, some of them being highly intelligent and obviously elite at their craft. To me, the betting part being legal is a scary scenario. As you see ESPN kind of start putting it on their website and these other sites, which have certainly increased interest, viewership, when it comes to attendance, but especially the first two. So to me, the Ohtani story and excuse and putting it on his interpreter kind of feels a little crazy to me. It feels off point. Also, the way in the last couple days, it's kind of been swept underneath the rug. I feel that that's been very, very weird as well. And what else would baseball do? For example, I listened to the Angels home television podcast. Shout out to Gooby, which I feel is excellent with their present play-by-play guy in Gooby. And there's just no mention of it. You listen to the Dodgers podcast, they talk about the standing ovation Ohtani gets. And to me, obviously, I'm a baseball fan. Obviously, I've worked around baseball in my life. And whatever it takes to kind of get over this is great. But Pete Rose is still not in the Hall of Fame. Barry Bonds is still not in the Hall of Fame, and Shohei Ohtani is excuse for this one seems a little weird. It would be a shame if we lost him back to Japan, and that's exactly what would happen. Everybody's like, you know, or not a lot of people as far as discussing something like this are saying, hey, you know, he'll never play again in MLB baseball. Well, he'll probably go back to Japan and have no problem and make close to the same money. Anyways, that's a big thumbs down for Ohtani. As an Angels fan, I certainly miss the talent. I don't miss the $700 million that he would have taken to DH for a year or two only and then get into his aging years. And I certainly know that the Angels organization didn't need any more controversy like this. Let's go. Turn this up, bro. Let's go. On a lighter note, in NFL news, they do one good thing, they do another bad thing, and I don't think one outweighs the other. But essentially, the kickoff is going to go to the USFL style, and you can go check some footage out on TikTok or any of the platforms, X, to check out how that is done. And I'm not going to try to be visual for you here in a podcast type format, but essentially all the charging kick team is going to be lined up around, it looked like the 25 or the 30 yard line, like a regular play. They're about 5 yards off of the receiving team's offensive line, I guess you would call it at that point. They can't jump the ball until the receiving team touches the ball. That guy, once he touches it, now it's just like a regular offensive line versus defensive line. And I think that was a very important move. The kickoff was a waste of 5 minutes of television last year. And essentially, we're going to get some new offense, some new plays happening in that time. Then they went ahead and negated all that with the NFL hip tackle rule, where the NFL is full of flags, and I have no idea what the refs are going to do to distinguish when guys are running 15, 20 miles an hour and a yard behind the guy, what a hip tackle is and what isn't. And so we already have a problem with ambiguity when it comes to the pass interference. We already have a problem with the speed of the game and how much it's slowed down. The anticlimactic part of replay that comes into the game is very bad for the television product. And now we're going to go ahead and stop the defensive players one more time on the hip tackle. To me, this is just such a big fail. I hate the idea. I think that everybody who's ever played football knows there's a risk of injury. These guys are getting paid lots of money to take that risk, and that's a big X on the NFL. They make one good move, then they go ahead and counteract it with a bad one. I think the most interesting franchise after all the free agent moves is certainly the Bears. They're obviously going to add to their offensive arsenal with Williams being first overall. They went ahead and traded Fields to the Steelers, which was probably a good move for the Steelers. Then they have Allen from the Chargers, a Hall of Famer there, combined with Moore. Obviously, they already have a world-class tight end, and they'll probably be drafting a running back when they do finally get to pick here. So I think the Bears are definitely a big winner. The Steelers went ahead and side Fields and Wilson, so they're a lot better off in that scenario. Obviously, the Ravens went ahead and grabbed Derrick Henry. I don't think you could have prototyped a player as he ages going to a better system for his skill set than Henry, and they actually needed him with a lot of injuries piling up in their backfield last year. And then the Texans, who had a top three defensive line analytic for the whole entire season, went ahead and added defensive end Daniel Hunter. That's going to be great. And essentially, the Texans are really going to be a problem next year. That's going to do it for the NFL. Let's go. In the NBA stretch run, nothing to see here, especially with March Madness going on as teams kind of start jockeying for position. Obviously, nothing has really been decided, but the Knicks are winning in spite of OG and in spite of Robinson and their leading player for the last 3 years in Julius Randle, and they just continue to win. They're sitting in the fourth seed with a chance to still catch Cleveland, and so big thumbs up to Tibbs over there for the Knicks, the head coach, where he's created a culture of get after the loose balls, D up your man. The general manager did a great job kind of putting those character guys together, which in the modern NBA is the whole NBA. Effort on loose balls, matchups on the wing, and guys that are willing defenders are much more important than a score, because a score is not going to be able to play defense because he's too busy doing all the scoring, and essentially he's not there for defense. And so it's about those pieces you put together around your leading scorer, and that's what makes a winning and or a losing team in the modern NBA. As we mentioned at the beginning of the season with the NBA and OKC as a breakout team, which we nailed on that one, and then the Minnesota Timberwolves, which we also hit on that one. The Houston Rockets was the third team that I decided that I felt would have the biggest game jump. boom, the Rockets come through for us here at Sports Fusion with a 9-game winning streak. They're doing it with a rising star in Jalen Green. Everybody is talking about Edwards. Everybody's been talking about Ja Morant. And obviously Tatum, still being very young, is the young superstar face of the NBA. But look out for Jalen Green, also a high pick, also in his third year. He's at 25-4, so 20 points, 5 rebounds, and 4 assists. They just did a great job of finding the right mix with Houston, and then obviously tanking for a couple of years really helped. But Sengun, then they went ahead and picked up Dylan Brooks. I mean, Brooks is a killer on wing defense, and essentially he can guard 3 different positions there. We see him kind of disrupt things with LeBron last year, and Sengun is a 21-9 guy now. That's the center who can move it out to about 12 feet, knock it down. Van Fleet, who they overspent for, is a nice general for that mix. And they're doing all this really without Thompson. But then they went ahead at the end of the first round, and the biggest drop in the NBA draft was Whitmore, and he was projected to be top 10. I think they got him around the mid-20s. And essentially they kind of put a two-headed monster at that wing defender slash score. Whitmore's coming through. Thompson's kind of trying to find himself, never was a really good scorer, and they're supporting Jabari Smith, who can also guard fours. Brooklyn gave up their 8th pick in a deal with Houston as well, so Houston will have the 8th overall pick this year in the draft. Houston is for real. They may be too late for this year, although they're right there in regards to maybe getting a play-in game, as Golden State will have to really turn it on. But next year, the Houston Rockets are going to be right there with OKC and the Minnesota Timberwolves. That's going to do it for another Sports Fusion. Next week, I'm going to go ahead and do a preview of the Angels season here, as they didn't spend a lot of money or overspend for starting pitching like many wanted in the Angel fan base. With that, I'm going to continue my podcast in regards to the Angels. Obviously, I touched base a little bit today with the Ohtani thing. Go to Facebook and like, share, and follow the Sports Fusion podcast, and that would be great. Thanks for joining me here today on the Grab Bag Show. We'll talk to you next week.